The headlines. Iran's leader says the U.S. political system is suffering a serious decline, no matter who wins America's presidential election. Residents of a remote village in the U.S. state of New Hampshire cast the first Election Day votes after final appeals from President Trump and his Democratic rival Biden. And Austria and Greece become the latest European nations to impose more lockdowns to combat the coronavirus surge in the continent. Hello, welcome to CISMUS. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has denounced the French president's support for the blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described as outrageous Emmanuel Macron's support for the insulting cartoons. Iran's leader was addressing the nation during a televised speech on the occasion of the birthday anniversary of Islam's prophet. Ayatollah Khamenei also slammed certain Arab countries for normalizing ties with Israel. He urged the Muslim world to enhance unity in the face of enemies' plots. Also in his remarks, Iran's leader criticized the U.S. over its policies in West Asia, said that Iran's policy will not be affected by who wins the presidential elections in the U.S. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the U.S. political system is suffering a serious decline, no matter who leads the country. He said that Washington's hostility towards Tehran cannot be removed because Iranians will never surrender to America's will. Iran's leader also spoke about the ongoing fighting between Azerbaijan and Armenia over Nagorno-Karabakh. He called for an immediate end to the fighting and warned that Iran will respond if terrorists approach its borders. Expand on Iran's leader's remarks a little bit with our guests for this. We have Mustafa Khoshchesh, a political analyst, who joins us. We also have Tawid Asadi, who's a political commentator. Welcome. Mustafa Khoshchesh, let me first start with you. If we were to look first at one of the issues that Iran's leader touched on, that is the French president's remarks on Islam, on Muslims. Tell us what stands out for you on that front from Iran's leader's statements.
Hello, thanks for having me. Well, what the Iranian leader said seems to be another notification and indication of the war of civilization that the Western civilizations insist on waging against the Muslim world. It's no surprise that Macron has said so, because just last year, one of the leaders, the presidents of one of the East European countries, if I'm not mistaken, it was the Hungarian president, who said that we want to stay Christian and Hungarian, or when they kept Muslim refugees and non-Muslim refugees, but from Middle East and West Asia behind barbed wires in winter time. And many of them died behind these barbed wires, but behind the borders of Hungary. And the statement was very expressive by the president of the country, who said that we want to stay Christian, and we do not want to see Muslims in there. So this seems to be a war of civilization, actually. The rise of the extremists, the right-wing extremists in Europe, in European parliaments and nations, is very much telling that how people are thinking in there. And they are being misled by their leaders, leaders such as Macron. Let's remember that Iran's former president, Khatami, presented the idea and introduced the idea of dialogue among civilizations. Although it was hailed at the UN 3 decades ago, or 2 decades ago, probably. And later, we saw that they shunned away from this idea, and they never came to realize how important it was. So it seems to me that Huntington's strategy and idea and theory is still underway. It matches pretty well with Paul Wolfowitz's doctrine in the United States, that speaks of containing other world states and the states that have the power to become a new global or regional power. That's what they've been doing, despite very, the words that people like Macron and others are saying about expression, freedom of expression. They have been containing freedom of expression. As the Iranian leader said, nobody allows people in there, the researchers, the university professors, to speak of certain issues like the Holocaust and many others. Not that they would like to reject it, but they just want to raise their questions, and they don't allow them, and they imprison them, fine them, and they don't let them conduct research. So it's somehow selective freedom of expression. When it serves their interests, they are for it. When it's not, they are against it. And this selective approach has come to pick up war against the Muslim world and Muslim civilization as its top priority, considering that in about 30 years from now, a major part of Europe and the Western civilization would be Muslims, according to studies conducted in the past decade. Also, the same is going to happen in the United States. So they are thinking of, you know, making Muslims the other. When they speak of Muslims and Muslim civilizations, they speak as if Muslims are the other that should be humiliated, the other that's barbaric, the other that's wild, the other that should be disrespected, the other that's superstitious, the other that should never receive any kind of value or attention. And when they want to be proud of themselves, they speak of the other as if it's, you know, such a human being that's not valuable. They treat Muslims as if they aren't the selected nation. This idea of being the selected nation comes from somewhere that we all do know where it comes from the Talmud, where they say that the, you know, Jewish community is the only selected nation of God, and others have been picked up to serve them as animals. No matter they are humans or not, they should serve them as animals. They've been treating, I mean, the Western civilization, they apparently have been mesmerized by this idea that they are the selected civilization and nation, and they could treat other people with total disrespect. So what Macron is doing as a leader is important, but it's not just one single stance against the Muslims.
Toyed Asadi, one of the other issues that Iran's leader has spoken about, and that's the American elections. He has said, of course, in terms of Iran, that it doesn't affect Iran because Iran doesn't pay attention to the people who come and go inside the White House. But one of the things that stands out regarding the American elections is the issue of fraud that has been pointed out by the U.S. president himself. And he has capitalized on that for his own personal gain, obviously. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the Supreme Leader, I think, today touched upon a wide spectrum of issues, most important of which I can refer to the U.S. election and the current status of the ties between Iran and the United States. Well, the core element of this speech and his mindset, indeed, is based upon the very fact that when it comes to the grand strategies of Washington, we see a continuation of the same hostile, rancorous approach that they have started from four decades ago, and they have continued on up until the moment. And the key point of concern, back to his speeches, is that this grand strategy stays there whether we like it or not, whether a Democratic or a Republican president comes to the office. The point is that at least in terms of grand strategy, it doesn't matter really who comes to take the office. But when it comes to tactically speaking, I mean, there might be some differences between two sides. But the truth of the matter is that this same approach could be referred to in several examples even before the 1979 revolution. If you remember 1953 coup in Iran, and if you remember what the United States has done throughout all these years, you will see one same trajectory of a kind of interventionist approach that Washington has started, and it has paved the way for further policies pertaining to Iran to take place. So what basically Iranian Supreme Leader mentions comes from this very notion that this hostility is going to be continued whether Joe Biden wins the election or Donald Trump comes to win it. All in all, there might be some small, slight differences between the two candidates, but at the time being, we cannot really put forth the claim that if Biden wins, there's going to be a paradigmatic shift in Iran-U.S. relations, knowing the fact that Biden is the same person who said that I'm going to take smarter approaches to be tough on Iran, and I insist on the word tough. So that means, sometimes there is this wrong assumption that with Biden coming to the office, there's going to be a whole air of change in the relations, and there's going to be a new atmosphere. I think with respect to the very fact that we have seen in the history several examples showing that, these kind of changes are not going to be that much seminal, they're not going to be that much effective. What one can logically claim and predict is that this change, if it takes place, is not going to be that much influential when it comes to the ties between the two countries. Back to the context in which the U.S. election takes place, we can also notice that there is a huge amount of difference back in there in the U.S.
Okay.
We see that it's highly tensious, and the Supreme Leader correctly referred to this tensious situation.
Mustafa Khoshesh, another point that needs to be highlighted here from Iran's leader's statement is how he has condemned some of the Persian Gulf Arab countries and efforts to normalize ties with Israel. He has said that these basically Arab regimes, as he said, have trampled upon Palestinian nation's rights by doing this, and that this is going to require really Muslim unity, something that is really necessary at this point in time regarding the normalization of ties that is happening.
Well, this seems to me a very complicated issue because from another angle, maybe they've done a mercy and they've done a good thing to the Palestinian nation, because these moves have forced Palestinians to stand more united. If you just paid attention to the Fatah movement, after several decades of compromise and peace negotiations, they have eventually picked up the path towards resistance, and they are getting closer and closer to Hamas. All of them are getting closer to Iran. So those that were really speaking of, they had anything to do, they had any kind of potential, they have any kind of manpower or any kind of spirit for standing against Israel, they are getting united, and they are getting more of, united with Iran, and they have come to realize what Iran has been saying all throughout the past several decades, that the only way to stand against the Israelis and get back the Palestinian land is resistance and not compromise. And this has been proved so far. Now, with regard to these Arab nations, what they think a part of this normalization comes because they intended to appease Donald Trump. Another part is they think that they can work out some kind of strong ties, security ties with Israel to, stand against Iran, being fooled, having been fooled that Iran is their enemy, while this is not the case, this has never been the case. Iran treats them as brothers and friends. Still, these rulers, because they intend to stay in power, they need Donald Trump's support, the United States support, the Israeli support. So they have gone for normalizing ties with Israel and developing security ties with Israel. But they don't know one single fact, that wherever Israel goes, it starts spying and doing security harms to the rulers of that nation and of that country. And they would, when the day arrives, the Israelis would never be shy of using the same power and intelligence to topple these Arab rulers. One. Two, they have been inviting more tension to the region. The Israelis have long been looking for a way out to transfer any kind of potential battlefield with Iran from where they are under siege on occupied territories, from north, from east, from everywhere.
Okay, I got to jump in. I'm sorry, Mustafa Khoshesh. I'm going to throw the same question to Tohid Asadi, and that's about how Iran's leader has highlighted this normalization of ties of these Persian Gulf Arab countries with Israel. Go ahead.
Well, actually, I can say that, but Mustafa mentioned this almost correct, knowing the fact that this normalization comes from not an ideological base, but sometimes from an economic base And we see that Israel tries to kind of legitimize its status by paying money to these countries in the region. And of course, the implication is that there is kind of division between states, governments on one hand, and people and nations on the other hand. So we know that when it comes to the Palestinian cause, there is this tendency among Iranian, among let's say other nations of Arab states, to just get around the same let's say corner and the same center to touch upon this issue. At the same time, some Arab states, most importantly, I can refer to Saudi Arabia and Emirates. They're trying to kind of ignore the tendency and wills of their people to not to support Israel and not to go through normalization option.
Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. Let me thank Mustafa Hoshesh, political analyst, and also Toid Esadi, their political commentator, with his statements. Thank you. Election day kicks off in the U.S., where Republican President Donald Trump and his Democratic rival Joe Biden are competing to enter the White House. Residents of a village in the state of New Hampshire have become the first voters to cast ballots on Election Day. A record number of more than 98 million people have already cast their early votes. Trump and Biden spent their final hours campaigning in swing states, whose votes are crucial to elect the next president of the U.S. National polls suggest a firm lead for Biden, but his lead is narrower in a handful of states that could decide the result of the Tuesday presidential election. A total of 538 electors are up for grabs in what is called the Electoral College system. To be elected president of the U.S., a candidate must win at least 270 electoral votes. More countries across Europe are imposing stringent restrictions to contain a resurgence of the coronavirus. Nighttime curfew begins in Austria on Tuesday and will remain in place until the end of November. Universities and high schools will move to distance learning, too. Also on Tuesday, a two-week lockdown comes into force in Greece's second biggest city of Thessaloniki. Flights will be suspended, and all places except schools will be closed. In Germany, the government has appealed to citizens to respect month-long shutdowns that took effect on Monday. Much of Portugal also faces a lockdown from Wednesday, while France is preparing to further tighten restrictions. Moreover, England is considering imposing a second national lockdown. Victim of a shooting that shocked the Austrian capital, Vienna, to the core has died from injuries. The death brings to four the number of people killed in the Monday attack. Officials say that a total of 17 people are being treated at several hospitals, mainly for gunshot wounds and cuts. They say that seven of those injured are in critical condition. Police shot dead one assailant during the attack. A nationwide manhunt is underway to capture other potential gunmen, with at least 1,000 officers involved. The Austrian Interior Minister says the attack was carried out by a sympathizer of the Daesh terror group. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has called the incident a repulsive terror attack. Meanwhile, sympathies and condemnations are poured in following the deadly shooting in Vienna. Iran's foreign ministry expressed sorrow and called for international cooperation to root out terrorism. The European Union condemned the incident as a cowardly act. German Chancellor Angela Merkel called for a common struggle to fight, quote, assassins and those who instigate them. The Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte said there is no room for hatred and violence in Europe. The Russian President Vladimir Putin called the shooting a cruel crime that revealed inhumane nature of terrorism. Other nations, including Britain, France, Canada, India, and Pakistan, issued similar messages. And that is for World News. That's bye-bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Democracy, directed by Swiss filmmaker David Burnett. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is John Rees, who is a writer, broadcaster, and author. Now, Democracy is a documentary that gives you an amazing insight into the legislative process at EU level, offering a compelling story about a handful of politicians trying to protect society in the digital world from the dangers of big data and mass surveillance. And following 2 long years full of pitfalls and accelerated by the upheaval of the Snowden affair, parliamentarian Jan-Philipp Albrecht and European Commissioner Viviane Reding worked together for a new law on the protection of personal data.
Many people say data is the new oil, the oil of the 21st century. If you think about how oil has transformed our lives, data is going to do the same thing.
Der Knoten meines Lebens. Wenn ich da als Minister sitzen würde, würde ich auch jemanden zuhören, der keine Krawatte trägt. Es geht darum, dass sie eine Datenschutzverordnung verabschieden sollen.
Data protection is a fundamental right, and the companies have the duty to explain what they do with our data.
European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused.
Surveillance is about managing populations, managing people.
That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
It is our responsibility to get these rights in place.
Who do you think would like to stop the direct?
Well, I think we know the usual suspects.
Well, first of all, warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary tackles an important issue of our time and gets behind the scenes of the European privacy debate. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Democracy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, fascinating and important subject, but for me, sadly, deeply unpersuasive treatment. I mean, it's by nature, you know, if you're going to follow lots of bureaucratic meetings with people kind of, you know, arguing over very, minutiae of clauses and things like that, there needs to be something to grip an audience. And, you know, first of all, it's filmed in this kind of very kind of nondescript greyish black and white. But I guess the director would say he's probably trying to avoid sensationalism or dumbing down.
Well, some critics have actually praised the film and its efforts and its monochrome sort of sequences and the black and white feel to it, because it is an incredibly tough subject to film and follow through. Perhaps the director made it for new audiences watchable, given it's a tough subject.
I mean, if people get something out of it, that's great. All I can talk to is my experience of it. And I do think this is an issue that, because it sounds quite boring, people do switch off. And I think unless you're preaching to the converted, if you want more people to be engaged in this issue and you want them to sort of sit up and take notice, you need to get their attention.
Just to bring in John here. John, are we as a society largely ignorant about data protection issues? Surely this film can help persuade people of this argument.
Well, it'd leave people going away with the idea, maybe I must find out what it's about. And also, the critical thing you see here is what happens when corporations that are privately assembling data for consumer management, which is one issue, an important issue, flips over into state access to that data. And that's what the Snowden case, of course, revealed. And that's
the only time
when the film really kicks off.
Mm-hmm. We'll discuss that a bit later on. But for now, we're going to turn at another clip from the film, which shows Viviane Reding, the European Commissioner for Justice, Citizenship and Fundamental Rights at the time, explaining the significance of data protection.
Ladies and gentlemen, the citizens are very worried. 72% of European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused. Our reform will assure a high protection to the individuals. A single set of European rules on data protection, fit for the digital age, valid everywhere across the European Union, on the basis that the personal data belongs to the person.
When I became Commissioner for Justice and responsible for the protection of the citizens, I knew at that moment I had to reform the data protection rules. Without trust, no digital economy. So it is in the own interest of the politicians who want to develop our economy and of the industry who wants to take advantage of the personal data of the individuals that clear rules are established so that citizens know, all right, I can hand out my data. That is exactly what we need. Because in this new digital world, no service can function without the data. The data are needed.
So that was the importance of data protection. Lee, what else does this film tell us about the significance of data protection? What arguments does it make, and you know, why is it so controversial?
Well, I mean, all the arguments that Viviane Reding makes and Jan-Philipp Albrecht, they're all absolutely valid, and they're things that we should be concerned about. But I would question one of the things she says there. She says, without trust, no digital economy. Now, the fact is, a lot of people, as they say, don't trust it, but actually, we all are kind of complicit because we so easily give our consent and agree to things and share our details that actually the digital economy seems to be doing quite well. And the issue is, why are we so pliant, and why do we give our consent so easily? And this is the thing. A film like this, or anything that discusses this, whether it's a news program or a documentary, should be trying to alert us and give concrete examples of what is happening with this data and why we should be more concerned.
Surely this is a testament to the documentary then. It's just simply following sort of the bureaucratic process and that bringing to light and to this issue to the public eye, whereas we would otherwise not know about these issues.
Well, again, I think its heart is in the right place. It wants to do that. I just don't believe it does. What this does is follow very diligently and, you know, obviously taking a long time, the trail, you know, the process of getting these laws applied.
So, John, for viewers who haven't seen this documentary, could you help contextualise this issue of data protection? Why is it such a huge issue?
Well, what for the first time in history you've got is major corporations being able to track, not by name, and that's important, but in general patterns, consumer behaviour at quite a detailed level. And there's a question mark about whether or not that should be, the degree to which that should be able to be done, and certainly able to be done without consent. And that's an important issue. But, and I have to say, that clip is very revealing, although the filmmaker doesn't make very much of it, because the film is framed as if it's a battle of, you know, kind of libertarians against the power of the corporations. But that's not what the EU does. In fact, what the EU does is it excludes cowboy capitalism so that the really big guys can agree on the rules and compete on that basis. That's what it does for the European area.
So who else can we rely on then to ensure that these checks and balances
well,
are
we're
in
coming,
place?
Well, we're coming to that, because the people who are actually the heroes of this story and the person who ignites this film is Edward Snowden. Mm-hmm. And those are the people who should, you know, Jan-Philipp Albrecht, all right, nice guy, green, trying to do his best, thinks the EU is a marvellous institution, wants the corporations to behave reasonably, fair enough. But that isn't really the person that smashes open this whole debate, even in this film. And he's supposed to be the hero of this film.
Interesting point you make. And we'll touch on Snowden again, as I mentioned, a bit later on. And Lee, if I could just quickly ask you, what were some of the obstacles that Jan faced then in his lobbying efforts?
Well, I mean, you know, this basic assumption that citizens are consumers and therefore we should be treated as such. It's like, therefore, you know, what's wrong? We're going to give you what you want. This is a shortcut. If we know, you know, the things that you're interested in and where, you know, what your daily existence is about, we can help facilitate that. Now, obviously, that's a very positive spin on that. The downside is, you know, it's about commerce and it's about selling things to people. And unfortunately, the kind of the positive benefits seem to get easily swept aside in the rush to kind of and they make sales.
I think everybody is aware that the lobby on this file is one of the most intensive that we've seen for a long time.
But this has been the most heavily lobbied piece of legislation in recent years. Why is it causing so much stir and interest?
It is important to understand that European companies are a major part of this growing internet economy. Some of the most successful global internet companies to date are European.
It just shows actually the conflicts between the giant internet companies and the rights of the individual in terms of protecting their data online. What were some of the conflicts, if you could shed more light on that, between these companies and data protection?
Well, I mean, aside from the whole commercial angle, there's the surveillance side of things. And the idea that if, as John was talking about, if the companies share this information with the state, what use is that information going to be put to? So in the UK, you know, famously, the sort of Snoopers Charter that came, you know, was announced November 2016, and is maybe hopefully going to be
passed into law last year.
Yeah, exactly.
Also known as the Snoopers Charter.
Yeah, exactly. So that whole idea is, if you get someone in charge, I mean, the US is perhaps a good example, who looks like they're cracking down on kind of, you know, freedom of information and things, then maybe that information is going to be misused. And this is a big worry for people. It's like, if you can pinpoint, maybe without specific names, but, you know, being able to identify people by so many characteristics, where does that, it's basically, where's this going to go? And if you're allowing this stage is, you know, gradual sort of erosion, then, you know, it's open to abuse in the future.
And John, so this film implies that giant internet companies such as Google, Microsoft, Facebook, etc., Yahoo, for example, that they have invested interests in data, against data protection. They don't like to be associated with these sorts of laws and things. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, I think every capitalist corporation just wants as much freedom as possible to gather as much information about its customers as possible and use it how it likes without legal regulation, transparency or oversight. I think that's a kind of given. And not just in this industry, by the way, but right across the board. I mean, big corporations are some of the most secretive bodies in our society. I mean, probably only the state secret service agencies are more secretive than giant oil companies or giant car companies. And of course, industrial espionage is a thing. So, you know, I think we have to take that as one of the ways in which a competitive, profit-seeking system works. That's what they want. That's what they want it to do.
So how can an individual, take on sort of a giant corporation like that?
You can't as an individual. The imbalance in power is too great. That's why they are collective, powerful collective entities. And if you're going to take them on, you need powerful collective entities on your side as well. Mass protest movements, trade union organisation, labour organisations, are different. That's why that kind of.
But why don't we see this then? Do you think there's an ignorance then on the public's part?
No, I do think that, and this film kind of underlined this. Yes, there's massive corporate lobbying going on. I think at one point in the film they say 96% of the lobbying that took place over this piece of legislation was from corporations and their various front organisations. And that's an interesting thing, because that will be happening not just on this bill but on every conceivable piece of Labour legislation that you can think about. I think people are concerned about that. We heard the figures, but you know, there are some things that are a lot closer to home than whether or not Google has got your consumer preferences, your health service, your wages, your welfare provision. These are things that are cutting into people's lives like right now and matter about fundamental things in their lives. If huge corporations get your data, perhaps they'll missell you things, perhaps they'll try and sell you things you don't want, and have things about you don't know about, and that's bad. But corporations don't have the power to arrest you, try you, imprison you, deport you. That's what the state can do. And so when the state has these powers, this is a wholly order different threat. And I think we've seen that the reaction to these two things by the public is different as well, because they understand that distinction.
So more sinister issues beneath the surface.
Edward Snowden revealed that secret surveillance activities went far beyond what anyone thought possible. Companies like Google, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft got together with the NSA and provided direct access to the back ends of all communicating systems.
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures. That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
The Guardian's editor-in-chief testified before Parliament that only a fraction of the leaked files have been revealed.
It's about 1% of what we were given. Only 1% of the information in those files has now gone public.
Yes.
The EU Justice Commissioner has spoken about the leaks from Edward Snowden and says that new legislation must be put in place to protect the privacy of EU citizens.
Anybody who uses digital equipment is put under some form of surveillance. And that seems to me is something which cannot happen without consent. It cannot happen without the consent of populations. So my message to the lawmakers is, please protect us.
What's the strength of this documentary Democracy, I think, is that it gives you an insight into the privacy battle before and after the Snowden revelations. So you sort of see that journey and struggle. Lee, how was the revelations a game changer, and did it make the EU go into more gear and make more progress?
I mean, funnily enough, the appearance of Snowden in the film mirrors his kind of, you know, explosion and effect in real life. It kind of jump starts, makes it personal, gives you a concrete example, and actually helps you understand and get a grip on something else. The impression the film gives is that that gives a new impetus to their fight. It gives something concrete, and they can point to that example of Snowden and say, you see, this is the sort of thing we're talking about. If this can happen in this case, it can also happen in these other cases, and therefore that's why our, you know, this issue is so prevalent. And I, you know, the film at least gives the impression that that helps win the argument that they're putting forward.
So finally, we get to discuss the Snowden revelations now in this part of the show. John, what did you make of the revelations, and was it a game changer for the EU and sort of the battle for privacy?
Yeah, I think Lee's absolutely right about this. I mean, it was a game changer, along with others, Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks, and so forth and so on. But that's the point, really. These are things that come from the heart of the surveillance state, and they're very, very shocking. And they have a political effect about, you know, this doesn't come out in film, and it should do, but they're about real things happening, about people losing their lives with illegal operations in Afghanistan and so forth and so on, about the treatment of prisoners by the United States and so forth. These are deeply important issues which did have a political effect, and they're about surveillance by the state. And this film doesn't really acknowledge quite what a big shift this is. It says it's a game changer in terms of their legislation, but we've suddenly moved from a film which is only discussing kind of corporate interest in data collection to the question of the state. And it's not surprising to me that that's where the film really becomes interesting. If this film had been 25 minutes long, the last 25 minutes of what impact did Edward Snowden have on privacy legislation going to the EU, that would have been quite an interesting, and it is actually quite an interesting documentary. So yeah, it changes gear, but it changes political focus and doesn't really quite acknowledge that it's doing that or why that might be important.
I just wanted to read an example now of Snowden. One of his revelations was that the NSA and the GCHQ here in the UK have far-reaching powers, particularly this country, that undermine privacy and security by variety of means, so unlocking encryption used to protect emails, for example, banking and medical records. And what's also controversial, which the film mentions, is that, you know, why should the US have the power and jurisdiction to spy on people in Europe? So one of the leaks that Snowden revealed was that an average of 3 million data intercepts per day in France, with peaks of almost 7 million in around 2012 and 2013 occurred. So this is the magnitude is just unsort of believable, really. So, and surely that having the EU in place can help buffer sort of and protect us from sort of the US spying.
Yeah, interestingly though, we're never told in the documentary to what degree the law that they're passing actually affects the relations between private corporations and the state, and between individual. I'm not even clear at the end of this whether or not that legislation applies to state bodies or not. Now that would have been an interesting thing to know, and to what degree, and do they avoid them, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's also a whole series of issues about the mistakes that the state system makes, because actually it can't process. It can mass data observe, but to get that down to so-and-so did so-and-so and is guilty of such-and-such is a very hard task, and the state often is misled, and injustices and miscarriages of justice arrive because it can't actually process this degree of raw data.
But so it seems like an illusion of power at this stage, more so than the capacity to follow through.
Yeah.
And Lee, if I could ask you sort of your personal thoughts on your data and how it's being used, did this film make you think and more sort of paranoid in any way or aware of how your data is being used?
Yeah, I mean, you know, truth be told, I'm so aware of it already. You know, you go onto a social media site, you're getting an advert for something you looked at maybe on a different computer 3 weeks ago just once. That is alarming to me. I got a new phone, I just, I parked my car, I went off somewhere, like a message came up saying, show me where my car was parked. Now, if someone else got hold of my phone, they would just have immediate access. It's obviously trying to do me a favour. Mm-hmm. Say, here's where your car is. Hopefully I would remember that, and maybe there'd be so you go out on a night and you forget where your car is, and it's a useful thing. But you're just so aware of this sort of network that's operating and, you know, able to kind of track and log and all this kind of stuff. So I have to say, sadly, this film didn't really do anything about that. And I think what John says is very right. This change from corporate to state thing, the state thing is the real worry. I mean, the corporation stuff, definitely, you know, I have issues with. But they almost piggyback on Snowden to give themselves a sort of, you know, third act lift. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily tie in together. But it is also doing a service, because there's nothing about the issues that this film tackles that I would disagree with. It's more just the handling of it and, you know, persuading more people to kind of pay attention. I don't think this film quite does it.
And so, John, just your final thoughts on the film now.
Well, I mean, I'd be interested in a kind of 10-minute sequel, because this piece of legislation passed. We all know that, as Lee's just said, this stuff is still happening to us at an exponentially growing rate. So exactly how effective was, after that long battle, after we've watched all this, how effective really, really was it?
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Chambriard.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. by Tahir Reza Jafar.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Welcome to another episode of For Humanity, a program in which we look at the beautiful treatise of rights, Risalatul Huquq, by our fourth Imam, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. The section of the treatise that we want to start discussing today is known as Haqqul Mas'ul, or the right of the person who has been asked. And as we have noted previously, when it comes to Risalatul Huquq, there are two versions. Basically, there is the version of Shaykh al-Saduq, which he has mentioned in his work Man La Yahdhuruhu al-Faqih, and then there is a lengthier version which is also more commonly known and more popular, which comes from the work Tuhaful Uqul, which is a little later, a 6th century work. So let us look at both versions first, and then we will discuss what the meaning and the connotation of what Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam is trying to express when he talks about the right of the person who is asked entails. So we begin by the lengthier version. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa amma haqqul mas'ul fa haqquhu in a'ta qubila minhu ma a'ta bil shukri lahu wal ma'rifati li fadlihi وطلب وجه العذر في منعه وأحسن به الظن واعلم أنه إن منع فما له منع وليس التثريب في ماله وإن كان ظالما فإن الإنسان لظلوم كفار. This is the lengthier version of this particular right, which comes to us in the work known as Tuhaful Uqul. In this version, the Imam alayhi salam says, as for the right of one who is asked, it is that if he gives, you accept from him with gratitude and recognition of his bounty, and accepting his excuse if he withholds, and keeping a positive opinion about him. Know that if he withholds, it is his own wealth that he is withholding, and there is no blame on him regarding his own wealth. And if he is an oppressor, then this is the nature of man, for indeed man is an oppressive ingrate. Now let us turn to the second version, which is the version noted down by Shaykh al-Saduq alayhi al-Rahma in his work Man La Yahdhuruhu al-Faqih. We note that this second version is much shorter. In fact, it is but one line. In it he says, وَحَقُّ الْمَسْؤُولِ إِنْ أَعْطَى فَاقْبَلْ مِنْهُ بِالشُّكْرِ وَالْمَعْرِفَةِ بِفَضْلِهِ وَإِنْ مَنَعَى فَاقْبَلْ عُذْرَهُ. The right of the person whom you ask is that you accept from him with gratitude and recognition of his bounty if he gives, and you accept his excuse if he withholds. Here now we see that there is a difference between these two versions. The first version was lengthier and the second one was shorter. However, the general message is the same. The message is that when we ask someone for something, the person who is asked also has some rights upon us. The first and most important right is that when he gives what is being requested of him, when somebody asks for something and he gets what he is asking for, then the right of the person who grants him the favor is that he should be thanked. One must show gratitude to him for accepting that request, for fulfilling that request. And so the first right of the mas'ul, or the one who is being asked, is that you should accept what he gives and be thankful for it, and realize that he has actually done a favor to you. And the second right is pertaining to if he withholds and he does not give you what you are asking for. If you imagine a scenario where you go to someone asking for a favor, asking for some financial assistance, for example, and the person rejects your appeal, he does not give you what you are asking for, he withholds his wealth from you. So when he does this, obviously he will do it giving some kind of excuse. He might say, I don't have anything to spare at the moment. He might say, I'm sorry, I cannot help you, for any reason that he has. So it is his right, therefore, that if he withholds his assistance from you, that you accept his excuse for doing so, and you have a positive opinion about him. Don't try and be suspicious of him and think negatively of him because he has not assisted you. Maybe his excuse is valid. At the end of the day, as the Imam says, it is his own wealth that he is withholding from you. It is not your wealth. It is not your right that he has deprived you of. Rather, it is a favor. And hence, because it is a favor, and he knows better whether he can spare that wealth or that assistance or not, then it is his right that we should look upon it positively and think to ourselves that indeed, if he was able to assist us, he would do so. So it is very important, therefore, that we realize that in this mutual process of asking and giving, both the one who asks and the one who gives or withholds have rights. And here the Imam alayhi salam is specifically talking about the rights of the one who is being asked. We pray to Allah Azza wa Jal to grant us the ability to fulfill the rights of all the people whom we meet and interact with in this world according to the teachings of Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alihi at-tahirin.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, what you've just listened to was the program For Humanity. If you have any comments or suggestions, email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, bear witness that I, to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that He's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is His messenger. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is His messenger.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.